12:10, this is WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch, produced by Pete Zimmerman. This is John Williams. The Dow is down 204, 205 points. The markets are seeing red today. We'll talk more about that and follow a bunch of business stories. Amy Guth will talk a little bit more about what's going on with J. Crew. I see a story at CNN.business as well today, not only about J. Crew, but JCPenney and Neiman Marcus, burdened by crushing debt loads. The article is headlined, "What J. Crew declared bankruptcy, three other famous stores may follow." So if it's J. Crew, is that just the first of many? Amy Guth will talk to us a little bit later on about that. And Orion continues to follow the food industry and the meat markets and what's happening there. I'm reading a lot about that, Orion, and I know you've been particularly interested in it and talking with us about that the last several days.
Right.
I did not go to the grocery store this weekend and see meat getting picked over, but people are now starting to do what's called panic buying and hoarding chicken and pork and beef.
They are, and that's not the thing to do, really, because I keep saying the supply is out there. We've got to work on the chain to get it from the ranch and the farm to the supermarket shelves and your dinner table. But and we've got to work on that. We're slowly opening some of the closed meat processors as two departments opened at the Sioux Falls plant operated by Smithfield Foods. And the employees are going to have to take a different trip to get inside the plant, but we'll talk about that later.
60 Minutes, I don't know if you saw it over the weekend, though, did a lot about the farm scene, the current policies, how we're managing all of this. And panic buying is something that they mentioned as well. It wasn't exclusively about that, but that sure was a topic on Sunday night.
And it will continue to be, even though we're opening some of the plants. But things, as one worker at a plant in Iowa said, things will never be the same for us again.
Why is that?
Well, because of the changes that will have to go into place
in order to enter the plant,
yeah. And so that'll change completely, but there is concern about the workers because there have been some fairly sizable illnesses reported because of the close proximity that they have to work to do the processing. So we'll talk more about that a little bit later, and the USDA is going to buy some more of our surplus food to provide food pantries and places where people do need the food.
It's Orion Samuelson. Okay, Jim Dahlke joins us again from Chicago Inno. Lots to talk about with you today, Jim. I trust you're well.
I am, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Speaking of that, let's just jump right in. There's a new COVID app. Is this specifically from or to Chicago to goes along with the vaccine rollout?
That's right. So just last week, Mayor Lori Lightfoot, along with the Chicago Department of Public Health, launched a brand new app just for the city of Chicago. So it's called Chi COVID Coach. It's a mobile-friendly web app that allows people to get information during the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. So, you know, not only is it kind of used for people who are currently experiencing symptoms, so it allows you to get text messages and other information about where to seek care, different information about available testing, information about symptoms, things like that. The city is also using this for when there is an ultimate vaccine down the road. So what they're hoping for is to kind of pre-register people for this. So once a vaccine is available, which, you know, could be months away, 2021, something like that, the city will have information for people to kind of roll this out once it's ready.
So this isn't for contact tracing, though.
Right. So what they're really hoping is that, you know, they can get ahead of this information, you know, kind of before where there's a huge bottleneck of people who say, whoa, I want to get on this list. I want to get a vaccine. I want to get access to it as soon as possible. So really what they're doing is kind of using it to kind of get data on folks who currently have coronavirus and the symptoms, but then also be able to kind of get people on the list before a vaccine is even ready so they can get all their kind of ducks in a row as early as possible.
I guess it's available for all platforms, right?
That's right. So, yeah, mobile-friendly web app, it's available for anybody. And really kind of what the city is asking is, you know, even if you don't have symptoms, go ahead and pre-register. So, yeah, available to everyone.
And what am I searching for when I go to the app store then?
Yeah, so what you're going to do is just go to Shy COVID Coach. So it's covidcoach.chicago.gov, and that's where you'll be able to access all the information.
Shy, as in Chicago, COVID, we know how that's spelled, and Coach, Shy COVID Coach. City of Chicago has an app there. How farmers' fridges, healthy vending machines fuel the frontline hospital workers. I saw this story today. I don't know that I've seen a lot of these healthy vending machines. What are you talking about here?
Yeah, so Farmer's Fridge is a Chicago startup, and what they've experienced is really kind of one of the more interesting kind of business pivots or shifts kind of in the COVID era. So Farmer's Fridge really focuses on these healthy vending machines that are placed mostly in airports and kind of building lobbies in cities like Chicago and New York and Indianapolis. And they're really there to kind of serve people healthy options, salads, wraps, bowls, things like that. And so, you know, a big piece of Farmer's Fridge's business was building lobbies. So people kind of walking between buildings, between meetings, grabbing a salad from one of these healthy vending machines on their way to work. Well, with everybody kind of working from home and very, very few people actually at the office, Farmer's Fridge saw its revenue absolutely plummet. In just a couple weeks sort of after stay-at-home orders were instituted, their revenue dropped about 70%. And so one interesting thing that they did is they really doubled down on hospitals. So hospitals represented about a quarter of their business prior to the coronavirus. They have really, really doubled down on getting their healthy vending machines within hospitals so doctors and nurses could access healthy meal options. And it's really interesting because a lot of cafeterias within these healthcare facilities were either shutting down completely or really limiting the amount of food that they could serve. So Farmer's Fridge basically was, in many cases, one of the only options for a lot of America's, kind of frontline hospital workers.
It's funny because we're all sending them food, but maybe it's not always the healthiest food either. They're getting pizzas and roast beef sandwiches, which are swell. I had one this weekend, but maybe it's better for us to think healthy as well, huh?
Exactly. And, you know, basically before all of this happened, Farmer's Fridge was in about 85 healthcare locations. They ramped that up to 140 now. And they say they're doing about 30,000 meals a week just specifically to healthcare workers.
What's the prognosis for them? No pun intended. I hope they come out of this as well as they went into this.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to the CEO last week, and, you know, along with kind of doubling down on the sort of the healthcare industry, they also launched a home delivery service, which is really interesting. So you can get these sort of same salads and wraps sent directly to your house. So they'd never had a delivery service before in terms of sending meals directly to somebody's home, and they kind of opened up that revenue stream as well. So, you know, they said that, you know, they continue to see a hit. The coronavirus is impacting their business, certainly, but they've been able to kind of sustain the business, not go through layoffs, not go through furloughs, by really kind of making sure they're focusing on healthcare facilities, focusing on delivery, and kind of just sustaining and hopefully coming out on the other end. So the CEO is confident that, you know, they're getting their revenue back to where it was pre-COVID in just the next few months.
Jim Dahlke's the senior editor at Chicago Inno. What's the MOM Project?
Yeah, the MOM Project is a really interesting startup in Chicago. So they are a jobs platform that connects companies with qualified female candidates. And really kind of their focus actually is women who have left the workforce to start a family, and now they want to reenter it. So the MOM Project really is focused on connecting those women to jobs. Some of their companies on their platform include Nike and Uber and Etsy and Facebook and know, what they've just did last week was they started a $500,000 fund, really that's aimed at focused on providing grants to family-friendly businesses. And kind of what that means is, you know, they're going to give grants to small businesses that employ a lot of women. And the goal is to kind of focus on, hey, hopefully these grants will keep more moms employed during the coronavirus. Hmm.
Chicago-based, are we looking for women in this area or throughout the country?
Yeah, so this is a Chicago-based startup, and certainly Chicago is going to play a big role in kind of what this grant is about. But, yeah, they are a national brand, and so they'll be kind of looking at companies, I think, across the country.
Are all of those web platforms to sell products doing well? We know about Amazon. Is Etsy doing well? Is eBay still out there? I presume all of those sites must be getting a lot of traffic.
And Etsy is a great example, actually, because, you know, we're seeing a lot of kind of craft makers really do well right now, especially around masks and some of these other PPP things. Etsy mask makers, I think, are probably doing obviously better than they ever have, right? So I think Etsy actually has carved out a really interesting niche for itself and, you know, creating opportunities for these kind of independent makers to get products in front of new people. So Etsy specifically is really, I think, seeing some interesting growth in this time period.
It's interesting, too, isn't it? The delivery times on some things, which you presume are somewhat related to the supply and demand. If you order a picture puzzle for your kids to put together, you might wait weeks for that. I ordered a jump rope. Because, the sporting goods stores are closed and I can't get much exercise these days. So we bought a couple of jump ropes online. And it was probably 2.5 weeks before those arrived in the mail. And finally did over the weekend. And I'm skipping now, but that's just the way it is right now, isn't it?
That's right. And I think the Amazon Prime has certainly seen a lot of delays. We've been using Amazon a lot on our end as well. And I've kind of noticed something similar. And so, yeah, I definitely think that Amazon is kind of prioritizing some of those more important elements right now. And so, yeah, the jump ropes and the puzzles can kind of get put on the back burner.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, well, better they get that than I get that. The first virtual demo day for Techstars. What's this all about?
Yeah, so Techstars Chicago is one of the most kind of well-known, highly respected startup accelerators around town. It's part of a national network of Techstars programs across the country. And every year, Techstars Chicago holds its demo day, which is really kind of a celebration of the companies within its latest cohort. And, you know, what was obviously different this year is that the Techstars demo day took place entirely virtually. So we have a story on Chicagoino about some of the companies that participated and some of the challenges there. And, you know, the kind of interesting thing about that is that, you know, these demo days for startup accelerators are really an opportunity for startups to strut their stuff, kind of explain a bit about what their business has done and how they've grown. But it's also, you know, an opportunity to connect with investors. You know, those in-person connections are really important for startups as they kind of finish these programs that take several months. And you know, that really kind of wasn't able to happen this year. So they're going to have to do some kind of, you know, innovative sort of approaches to connecting these startups with investors, with potential customers, and it all happens virtually, right? So it's been interesting to see how programs like this and others throughout Chicago's startup ecosystem have kind of shifted and maneuvered to kind of continue to help grow these businesses in these kind of strange times. So completely virtual demo day for Techstars.
Am I confusing this with something else? Is this kind of run like a contest? And if you go to the next round, whoever wins gets the largest amount of funding?
So there definitely are startup competitions like that. So this one is more of just once the 10 companies are selected, they're in throughout the duration of the program, they get $120,000 investment from Techstars, and then an opportunity to kind of, you know, meet new investors, meet new customers, and kind of grow within the network that Techstars has built. So there's no kind of moving on to the next round, but there are a lot of programs like that, especially at the university level. So the University of Chicago, Northwestern University, a lot of these university programs have startup pitch competitions where companies will move on to round two, round three, ultimately to the finals. And, you know, as you can imagine, those programs are also happening virtually too and are kind of running into the same challenges that we're seeing here with Techstars, right, where a lot of entrepreneurs want to connect with investors, want to connect with potential customers, potential users, and those things are just not happening in person.
Yeah, I think we're discovering, right, that in some instances, virtual technology is enabling some things to flourish or can be done just as well and maybe more economically. And then some things, you want to touch the gadget. You need to see the people. You've got to have a little more interpersonal interaction. And maybe it depends on the product, right? If it's an app, maybe I could sell it to you over a computer. But if it's a gizmo, then maybe you and I need to be in the same room, right?
Totally. And I mean, if anybody who's been through the sales process knows that an in-person sales pitch is just different than what you're going to get over Zoom, you know? So I think what people are finding is that a lot of these digital technologies have worked really well. In a lot of instances, I think we're working remotely potentially better than we thought we could. I think a lot of these programs are becoming, you know, sort of effortless in how we operate business. But some of those things just cannot replace that in-person touch point. And I think, you know, one thing that the Techstars founders found is that, you know, they're just the presentations are not as dynamic as they are in a live setting. And so it's a little harder for startups to kind of really sell their wares.
Well, that's what we've all experienced, just trying to have, you know, weekend get-togethers with our friends, if it's a Zoom party or some other platform. Maybe that's another area where technology is going to realize there's an opportunity here. Better, you know, develop an app so people don't talk over each other. Develop a system that is more user-friendly or dynamic for displays. Develop an app that better enables me to maybe see your room or, I don't know, just think of all of the things that we're trying to do with, say, a Zoom meeting that probably could be enhanced, but they never thought they would have such a demand for the product itself.
Mm-hmm. And one of the big things I think it's missing is a networking component. You know, you can put together a virtual event, but it's very difficult to replicate those in-person connections that you make when you attend an event like that. We just put on our very first virtual event on Friday, and it was a great kind of one-on-one fireside chat with a founder in Chicago, and we had, you know, a couple hundred people on that event. But you know, the one thing that's missing is those sort of connections that you have while you're grabbing a bite with somebody after the panel is over. So looking to find ways to replicate that for sure.
Yeah, no kidding. Jim Dahlke, Senior Editor, Chicago Inno. Appreciate your time, Jim. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
We'll visit next Monday with him. The Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. Elise Glink joins us on Mondays, real estate and financial wellness expert. She's the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. A lot of ground to cover on the real estate side and some other areas as well. Hi, Elise. How are you?
Hey, John. Doing well. Thank you. You?
Good. And the markets could be doing better, although we're off 200, which these days isn't so bad. But what's going on there and what do you think about it?
Well, I think the markets are doing a lot better than they did first thing this morning when they didn't look good at all. Asia was down, and so some of it is still down in excess of almost 3 and 4%. So I think given that we're only 200 points down, I'm okay with that.
200 on the Dow. And any particular reason for this today? Although, again, to me, off 200 is the new even, you know? We're so used
really
to it being off
much,
500,
right?
600. That doesn't sound, if it closes the day that way, I don't think it'll get much notice.
No, I don't think so. But there was a lot of uncertainty over the weekend. We heard that Warren Buffett cautioning the extreme consequences from the Fed's recent move. There's a lot of volatility out there. You know, we see whenever you hear Elon Musk say anything these days, or, you know, on the flip side, Jeff Bezos saying, investors, sit down, I'm taking all of the profits and using them for something else. You know, as an investor, you're going to be concerned, and there's just going to be more volatility. So this is what volatility looks like.
Fascists, was that the word that Elon Musk was screaming last week?
He was screaming a lot of different things, and he's the one who's sending ships into outer space to help us with our internet and to get people to the moon. So, yeah, go figure.
And just one quick note about Warren Buffett's decision to dump airlines. I mean, they don't need any more bad news, but that sure is a bad sign, isn't it?
It is a bad sign, and he sold it at a tremendous loss. I think he announced in his shareholders meeting that he was down something like $49 billion on it. That's a big loss for Warren Buffett, and he's sitting on a lot of cash. He's added to that. But for investors, I think almost the more unnerving thing was that his sidekick, Charlie Munger, wasn't there at the meeting. And so Charlie's even a little bit older than Warren Buffett, and we hope that he's feeling okay if he's not.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have changed the way they're structuring some of these loans or the guarantees on some loans, right?
Yeah, they are. And this is, I think, good news for mortgage servicers. So the CARES Act provided that people could put their mortgages into forbearance if they needed to. And that's great, except that the mortgage lenders who were supposed to be receiving your payments are supposed to turn around and pay those to the investors. You don't pay the lender can't pay the investor, but still was required to pay the lender, the investor, legally. And so there was a huge uproar about how all of those payments were going to be made. And you have to understand that more than 7% of all Americans with mortgages have already put them into forbearance. It's closing in on 4 million Americans right now. And not making those payments amounts to billions and billions of dollars. And so Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac stepped up and said, we're going to do it for 4 months. We'll backfill for 4 months. And everybody said, well, then what will happen? And so now they're just going to backfill all of it. And so whether it's 180 days or 360 days of the forbearance, it matters that they're going to do this, because otherwise the mortgage market was starting to really freeze up, and that would be bad for anybody trying to buy or refinance.
Do you know, though, at least what happens then after, say, 6 months or 12 months? That is, if I've had forbearance extended, do I owe 13 months and the 13th month, or do they put those other 12 months on the back end of that mortgage and I only owe this month's rent?
It's a great question, John. Here's how it's supposed to work, and we're not there yet, so I can't promise you for sure it will, but nobody is going to be able to, after a year of unemployment, let's say, or 6 months of unemployment, be able to come up with 13 months of loan all in one. And so what they're supposed to do is either tack all of that missing payment onto the back end of your loan, and or they're supposed to do a loan modification, neither of which are supposed to negatively affect your credit.
Well, that's really good news. If that happens, then this makes sense. But you know well, 2 weeks ago anyway, people were up in arms about how it was just delaying the pain and making it worse if they put it on the back end, or if they let you restructure it so that you can afford it, maybe lower rate, maybe just lower payments, and they don't nick your credit rating, because then you're never going to be able to borrow money anyway, not at a reasonable rate. Then they got it right. That's the plan?
That is the plan, and I am full of confidence that that's what's going to happen.
We'll pause while you bring your cars back on the road. A lot of people are moving from the city to the suburbs, you say, right now. Why is that?
So we're hearing anecdotally that people in the city are really feeling the confines of the COVID pandemic. And so being forced to stay shut up into your apartment, not being able to use the elevator except more than one person at a time. We're hearing anecdotally, because it doesn't show up in the data yet, according to Realtor.com, that people are starting to look to the suburbs for more space, the ability to get out of their houses whenever they need to and walk around. And so there are a couple of early indications that could be happening. But if so, I have to say this will be the realtors' best news ever, because they have been waiting for millennials and little kids to show up for a long time. And so we'll see if that's really the case, probably another month or two from now.
But does your data still show that while the volume of houses sold is down, the prices have been holding pretty good?
They are, which is great news, particularly here in Chicago, since we never really recovered from the Great Recession. And a lot of people have taken big losses on their property, don't want to add to that. So I'm not saying that everything here is all hunky-dory, but what they are seeing, and actually Danielle Hale of Realtor.com, she's the chief economist, she confirmed that for me this morning, that prices seem to be holding steady. And buyers are not expecting to get big discounts. So that's good news for sellers. But again, it's too soon to know. Real estate kind of works in arrears, in that you put down your contract and you're going to close in 30, 60, or even 90 days. We're only, 6 weeks in now to the whole COVID pandemic, so we won't really see the data on this until probably maybe the end of May or even the end of June.
And can you expand a little bit on why people would be moving from the city to the suburbs? Are they imagining that they're going to be living their lives differently after this?
I think that there's every expectation that people are going to look as differently at the world as we all did after 9/11. So it's hard for people under the age of, say, 40 maybe to remember this, but prior to 9/11, do you remember that you could walk somebody to their gate and kiss your loved ones goodbye without going through security?
Mm-hmm.
Like, people, that's a different world, and that's kind of the world that, the kind of world change or sea change that I think we may see after the pandemic subsides. I think people will make very different decisions about how and when they travel, where they go, how they get there, how they live, and what they want to, where they want to live, and what they want to live in. And we'll see what those differences look like probably 6 to 9 months down the line after the presidential election.
I was talking to a home builder. That's an interesting point. I was talking to a home builder, and they were telling me how people are reimagining how they're designing their houses with offices maybe built in, not just a back bedroom that they've rejiggered, you know?
Yeah, I think that it's not going to be acceptable anymore to just have so-so internet coverage in your neighborhood. I think you're going to need to be able to get, you know, top-quality internet coverage no matter where you live, because if you need to work from home, you're going to have to be able to. And Zoom or, you know, Hangouts going out in the middle of a call just isn't going to work for people.
You made passing reference to the election. We're out of time here, but just were you thinking about something more specifically, Elise?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with real estate over the next 9 months. So we have the election coming up. Typically in an election year, real estate slows down anyway. I'm just not sure if on top of the pandemic slowness, right, where the number of listings is cut in half, if we'll also see a presidential election effect as well. Mm-hmm. And we will just have to wait and see for that.
Yeah, it might be hard to tell which is which. Elise Glink, nice to talk to you, Elise. Let's visit again next Monday, if not sooner.
You bet, John. Thanks.
It's 12:41. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Remember the Super Bowl ad fight between Anheuser-Busch InBev and Molson Coors? InBev made fun of Coors brands for using corn syrup. Well, it's still in court, and Molson Coors had been winning many of the lower court rulings, but InBev just won a big one at a federal appeals court. The appeals court says if Molson Coors doesn't like the ads, they should mock InBev products in their own ads. Farmer's Fridge sells healthy food through vending machines in office buildings. It was a nice business until people stopped going to office buildings. Now the company has pivoted to hospitals. Chicago Inno says they were in 85 healthcare facilities on March 1st. They're now in 140. And here's how the pandemic might be good for the cannabis industry. Cranes reports there's a move toward passage of the Safe Banking Act that would allow them access to banking services rather than having to do all their transactions in cash. Could also give them access to loans and credit they would need to expand in Illinois. I'm Steve Bertrand. That's the Wintrust Business Minute.
I think I know what you're going to talk about, Orion. What have you got on your mind, sir?
Well, first of all, a quick look at the markets, because they are mixed today agriculturally. We find wheat prices higher, corn and soybeans are trading lower. And in livestock futures trade at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, pretty much a green screen. Livestock futures are higher. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue today announced details of $470 million in Section 32 food purchases to occur in the third quarter of 2020. That's in addition to the purchases previously announced, which will enable USDA to purchase surplus food for distribution to communities nationwide. These purchases will provide additional support for producers and Americans in need in response to the changing market conditions caused by the COVID-19 national emergency. Don't have time to go through the different categories they'll be purchasing, but things like asparagus and orange juice and chicken and pork and prunes and raisins, too. But a lot more included in that purchase list by the USDA. The chairman, chief executive of Tyson Foods, Noel White, today said the coronavirus crisis will continue to idle U.S. meat plants and slow production. That was said in a statement this morning in a news conference with reporters. Tyson reported lower than expected earnings and revenue for the quarter ended on March 28th. And that's before processors shut massive processing plants as the respiratory illness spread among workers. Shares fell more than 8% for Tyson today. As Tyson also said, meat sales will fall in the second half of the year. That's because the outbreak has reduced restaurant demand. And the concern that the meat industry has, besides the processing itself, is also the transportation system to get it to people. But the processing capacity that we have for pork in this country has gone down about 50%. And the chief executive said there have been some shortages in some specific categories. But Tyson is working with government officials to resume operations at a huge beef plant. It closed in Dakota City, Nebraska. The company all over the weekend was receiving results from COVID-19 tests it performed on employees of another shuttered beef plant in Pasco, Washington. And we talked a good deal about why people are moving to the country on our Saturday morning show, and according to your conversation on why, we should maybe play that again next week, because Ray Brownfield, who is a specialist in farmland management and farmland sales, said people sort of want to get away from the crowded areas, and so they're looking to country facilities to move to, and that we'll have to keep an eye on. And then a quick note about county fairs, because we're getting into the county fair season next month, and I'm concerned about whether or not they'll take place. I talked a couple of days ago to a good friend of mine in Arizona, in Yavapai County, Arizona, cattleman Andy Grossetta, and they start their county fair season earlier than we do. Their fair was underway this weekend. It was a virtual county fair. The exhibitors from 4-H and FFA shot video on the farm, and then a judge who judges cattle for a living, he's from California, he sits down in front of a TV screen and does the judging and picks the winner. Yes, life will certainly be different.
Have they said about the state fair much, Orion?
A 50-50 chance right now, but they're sort of on hold and pending because, you know, we've got Illinois State Fair, Wisconsin State Fair, Indiana State Fair, and the Minnesota and Iowa State Fairs all coming up in late July and August. And, yeah, there is concern about whether they can be held under the distancing rules that we have to follow.
They haven't said either way. You're thinking 50-50. It could go either way, huh?
That's what one state fair official had to say, that he thought right now we have a 50-50 chance of having an Illinois state fair.
And is the glass half full or half empty? Thank you, Orion.
Okay.
That's Big O. Amy Guth joins us on Mondays with a bunch of business news. It's not just Mondays, and it's a bunch of news with you today, Amy. I was maybe not surprised, but also sad to see some of the mainline retailers' names we know now also falling victim to COVID-19.
That's right. So J. Crew has filed for bankruptcy, and that represents, that's one of the first major retailers that we're seeing that from. There is a lot of speculation that Neiman Marcus and JCPenney might be right behind it. Both of them have been kind of teetering on that edge for a while. That's been circulating about Neiman's for a while. But J. Crew has made that official earlier today. And they, yeah, like I said, they marked the kind of the first major retail bankruptcy of the pandemic. Now, what they hope to do is they have about 13,000 workers. They furloughed about 11,000 of them. But they do say that once things get reopened, they do hope to minimize any job loss from that. So they are hoping to reopen. What's interesting about this bankruptcy is that normally at this point, once your new creditors take over, they take control of the board, and it allows your stores to remain open. But since nobody's stores are open right now, they're just going to pause on that part and allow them a little bit of time to get through this part. But it'll be very, very interesting to watch who follows that. You know, like I said, Neiman's and JCPenney, a lot of conversation has been happening that they would be very close behind.
You know, I'm just wondering what sort of federal assistance was available to the likes of a J. Crew. We all know that when some of the money going out to businesses went to big businesses. A lot of people balked at that, but you don't want to see these companies declaring bankruptcy either. I wonder what the thought is on the federal obligation or even the ethic of the federal government helping these companies out.
Right. And, you know, what, one thing that I think is important to note about J.Crew in particular is they did have some financial woes that started way pre-pandemic. So in 2011, they had a leveraged buyout. They attempted, they own Madewell stores also, and they attempted to go public and do an IPO with them, and that didn't work out. And they had to kind of sit on that for a while, which could have been a big cash generator for them. So they already were in a tough spot leading up to this, and the pandemic did not help matters, as it hasn't for anybody. But I wonder that too. I think there's a lot of conversation that, you know, in this story, all of this moves so fast, especially, you know, the business and economic part and the healthcare part of all this moves so quickly. I think it's as we go through each month looking at numbers and looking at impact, it's going to tell more and more of a story of how things played out, who stepped in where, and how the cards fell.
Jim Dahlke talked to us earlier and mentioned that Warren Buffett said that he's going to dump his airline stocks and that it's just going to be a different world after this. Do you have much to add to that?
I mean, Jim Dahlke is always very thorough when he comes onto the show, and so I don't know how much I could add that he did not already cover. But, you know, I think this is really another very interesting story to have Warren Buffett coming out at the shareholders meeting on Saturday in Omaha for Berkshire Hathaway going, you know what, I was wrong. I thought I had, you know, I really think this was the plan for airlines. He had big blocks of them that he sold off in April, and he said, you know what, now we've dumped them all together. Wrong call, not the direction we're going. Talking about the future of air travel, he's like, he's even saying that he himself may not ever fly commercial again. So I think, you know, that's a bold move when I think a lot of people, especially people connected to airlines, as you and I talked about last week, are really waiting with very bated breath to see what does this economic recovery look like for airlines. As each passing week goes and the numbers continue to get worse, I think hopes for this quick bounce, V-shaped recovery fades. But nonetheless, I think with Warren Buffett saying that I don't think instills any consumer confidence to anyone about the airlines recovering anytime soon.
Yeah. The sage of Omaha is 89 years old, and most folks don't win betting against him. But, boy, you hope he was wrong on this one. Berkshire Hathaway had sizable positions in major U.S. airlines, including an 11% stake in Delta, 10% of American Airlines, 10% of Southwest, 9% of United Airlines. Doesn't want anything to do with those stocks now. Hospitals are gearing up to resume elective surgeries. Well, that's good news for both ends, the provider and the consumer.
That's right. So as of May 11th, certain hospitals that meet criteria can be able to do this. Now, that criteria is 72 hours prior to a procedure that the patient needs a COVID test and then a temperature check on the day of. But here's why that's really important, is because so many hospitals in the area, this is their big, big revenue generator. Elective surgeries account for a huge amount, 50 to 70% of revenue in some cases. So hospitals are saying, hey, since this has started, since this fall off began, we're looking at huge amounts, tens of millions of dollars a month in lost revenue. So there's already been hospital outreach for state help. We'll see how that goes. But looking at this, so, you know, May 11th, that's really important, especially for safety net hospitals, because what we want to do is not lose hospitals due to this. So not only did hospitals have to shut down this big moneymaker, that their big cash cow, meaning elective surgeries, like outpatient stuff, knee replacements, things like that, but they also had to spend a lot more because they had to gear up to get PPE and pay higher wages to frontline workers in some cases and things like that. So hospitals already were in a tough spot. The healthcare costs were rising. There was a lot of pressure for hospitals to consolidate. That's why we started last year and leading up to that, seeing major consolidations and buyouts of hospital systems, trying to consolidate systems and confine maybe this is going to be the heart one and this will be the maternity one, and kind of moving things around and in some cases compromising healthcare. So the reason why this is so important is because having that line of revenue open to hospital systems again can help cushion the blow when they're out money at a time when they were already losing a lot of revenue on top of a really pressured moment.
Yeah, mark it down, May 11th, Loyola Medicine and others. Okay, Amy, we'll talk tomorrow. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much.